I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder of the Langer Labs at MIT, one of the world's largest biomedical engineering labs with $10 million in annual grants and 100 researchers. He's pioneered the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery, which has led to the development of over 30 companies. He is a father of three children and a magician. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Your influence on the biomaterials field is vast, and I'd like to start with the early days of your professional life because, in a way, it helped to inform what you are doing today. After graduating from Cornell, you were a graduate student at MIT, and this was during the 1970s, during the energy crisis. How did the energy crisis indirectly lead you to the field of scientific discovery?
Sure. There was this gas shortage, you know, all over the country, and the gas shortage in Boston was really bad. So there were all kinds of jobs in the petrochemical oil industry for chemical engineers. They were hiring like crazy. Pretty much my colleagues, my friends, that's what they did. They got jobs in the oil industry, and so I thought that's what I should do too. So I went to a lot of interviews, and I got about 20 job offers from different oil companies, actually four from Exxon alone. But I remember one of them in particular, one of the engineers said to me, you know, if you could just increase the yield of this one chemical by like 0.1%, he said, that would be wonderful. It'd be worth billions of dollars. And I remember flying home to Boston that night thinking to myself, I just don't want to do that. It just seemed to me, you know, that I could, there were things that I could do with my life that I thought maybe could help people and would be more important, at least to me. So I started looking for other ideas about what I could do.
Now, you sent some ideas for a chemistry curriculum to various education institutions. How were they received?
One of the things I did when I was a graduate student at MIT is I helped start a school for poor kids and high school, and I got involved in creating new chemistry curricula. And so I remember writing letters, answering different ads to different colleges to be an assistant professor that would be developing new chemistry curriculum. But none of them wrote me back. So the next thing I thought about, since I wasn't doing so well finding good jobs or finding any jobs where I could do chemistry education, I thought about medicine. So I wrote a lot of hospitals and medical schools, and they didn't write me back either. But one day, one of the people in the lab where I was at said to me, Bob, there's this surgeon in Boston named Judah Folkman. And he said, sometimes he hires unusual people. He thought very highly of Dr. Folkman. I won't say what he thought about me. But I wrote to Dr. Folkman, and he was kind enough to offer me a job.
And it was your research with Dr. Folkman that had a seminal impact on what you're doing today to some degree. What was it specifically that you were working on?
So Dr. Folkman had a theory that if you could stop blood vessels from growing in the body, that might be a new way to stop cancer someday, a new way to treat cancer someday. But it was a theory, and actually a lot of people didn't agree with that theory. And what he asked me to do was to see if I could isolate what would become the first inhibitor of angiogenesis, the first inhibitor of blood vessel growth. So that's how I got started.
If you could stop the growth of blood vessels, you could stop the growth of tumors developing further. Is that correct?
Yeah. The thinking was is that tumors without blood vessels will not go beyond a very tiny size of about 1 mm³. But if the tumor is permeated by blood vessels, then that solves the nutrition problem for them, and they can get much bigger. And then, of course, they can also metastasize or spread through those same blood vessels and set up shop in other parts of the body.
You used an eye of a rabbit to help with your research. What is special about the eye of a rabbit?
Yeah, well, it's big, so it's easy to visualize. So what we thought about was if we could have a plastic, a slow-release polymer, that could take anything that was in cartilage, that's what we were studying, and A, not cause harm to the eye, and B, deliver those molecules for a couple months or more, that might be a way to study how blood vessels would grow or not grow.
You mentioned polymers. These are plastics, essentially.
The polymers we use would be plastics. Polymers could also be rubber and so forth. Polymer is basically a long chain substance.
We're talking about manufactured tissues, polymers. What was the landscape of biomaterials when you were pioneering this field in the 1970s?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Most biomaterials that people used in the body were largely driven by medical doctors, clinicians. And what they do is they would often go to their house and find an object that would kind of resemble the organ or tissue they wanted to fix. So just to give a few examples, the material in the artificial heart, that was a lady's girdle material because it had a good, you know, good buoyancy or flex life. And the material in a breast implant, that was actually, one of them was actually a mattress stuffing because it was the right squishiness. The material in a what's called a vascular graft, an artificial blood vessel, that was a surgeon going to a clothes store and finding something they could sew well with. And so almost all of the biomaterials in the 70s had origins like that. They were sort of what I'd call off-the-shelf materials. And that may solve some problems, but it also created problems because they weren't optimally designed for the body. For example, if you take the artificial heart, the lady's girdle material, you put it in the body and sometimes the blood hits the surface of that and it forms a clot. Mm. And that clot could go to the patient's brain and they'd get a stroke and they die. Mm. And obviously there's been problems with different breast implant materials and other things as well.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chemical engineer, Dr. Robert Langer, who is the chief researcher and founder of the Langer Labs at MIT. He's considered a pioneer in the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery. In the 1980s, you founded the Langer Lab at MIT. What was the purpose for this lab?
My goals were to do things that I thought might someday help and improve people's lives by doing things at the interface of chemical engineering and medicine.
How was it received when you went to the administration at MIT and said, you know, I'd like to form this lab just to facilitate this research that I'm doing?
Yeah, well, certainly my early years of doing the research, you know, a number of my senior colleagues didn't think it was very important or didn't think it was very good, and they suggested that I probably should start looking for new jobs.
Why was it? Because your field was so nascent, there weren't a lot of... Why was that?
I think that people's idea of what's important probably has a lot to do with what they're doing themselves. And, you know, and they had different areas in this department, but this didn't fit into any of those. And I think the thinking was if I didn't fit into something that pre-existed, I probably wouldn't get promoted. I probably wouldn't get tenure.
Since your research wasn't well received at MIT, did you ever think of maybe moving to an environment that was more friendly to the type of work you were doing?
Well, I actually think MIT was as friendly as any place. You know, my first 9 grants were turned down, and nobody at MIT were on the sections that turned them down. In fact, MIT was you know, I still think is a great place to be. If you go against the prevailing scientific wisdom anywhere in the world, you're going to run into problems.
So how did you break through that conventional bias?
Well, I don't know if I really ever did. I just kept doing the work that I thought was important, and I started, you know, publishing it. And I think pharmaceutical companies started to notice it. And they said that they were nice enough to say that the work they thought was very important.
What were some examples of early breakthroughs that helped to lend credibility to what you were doing?
So we had published this paper in 1976 in Nature showing that you could deliver molecules of almost any size. So that was probably the breakthrough, or that was maybe the first breakthrough. But people thought trying to get these molecules, big molecules, through a plastic was kind of like you or I walking through a brick wall.
Even though the plastic was porous?
Well, people didn't know that then, and we didn't know that then either. So the challenge would be the following. You could either have something that would be non-porous that you couldn't get through at all, or anything that was porous would be kind of like Swiss cheese, so you could get through it, but then you'd get through it almost instantaneously. Mm. And what we were seeing was that we'd have these tiny little particles, and yet the drugs would come out for over 100 days. So the problem would be, how could that happen? And that just defied what I like to say, conventional wisdom.
We talk about your research gaining academic acceptance. What was the first example of the commercialization of one of your findings?
Well, there were a couple, but I think one of the early ones was we designed polymers that could dissolve in a certain special way, and what we call surface erosion, kind of like how bar soap dissolves. And what was done in this particular case is it delivers an anti-cancer drug. It's all done locally, so the cancer drug doesn't go throughout the whole body. It just is given locally to the tumor. And then there was a company originally Nova Pharmaceuticals and later Guilford Pharmaceuticals that licensed it and developed it, and ultimately it led to a product that's still used today, actually, in treating brain cancer called the Gliadel wafer.
This is one of the earliest examples of the commercialization of one of your discoveries. Since then, roughly 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed your discoveries. Were you surprised by this torrent of commercial applications for what you were doing?
Yeah, it's hard to say whether I was surprised or not. I wanted people to use it. You know, when you're in academia and you're a professor, I mean, you're training students, which I love to do, and you're making discoveries and findings, which is also what I like to do. But I also want to see what we do get used. I just don't want it to be a scientific paper that just, you know, people read about. I wanted to see what we did have an impact on people's lives. That's why I got involved in the patenting process, and that's why, you know, I wanted to see our things get licensed to companies and ultimately license, you know, create companies ourselves, because if we didn't do that, you know, I find if you're not your own champion, it's very hard to find others who are going to be.
Often there's controversy around tech transfer of universities or academics using their discoveries for commercial ends because it leads to potential conflicts of interest. What was that landscape like for you?
I think MIT, you know, along with Stanford, is probably the top two technology transfer places in the world. And I think their goal is really the same as mine. It's not actually to make money. It's really how can we, you know, maximize the chances of products being developed.
MIT, which was founded in 1861, one of its missions was to provide and support industrialization of America. So MIT had more of a commercial slant to it than perhaps other academic institutions.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think MIT wants to see products created. They want to see things get out to the public.
Incidentally, once a technology or an innovation is discovered and is profitable, it's split in three ways. A third of the profit goes to the department, a third goes to the university, and a third goes to the inventor.
As far as I know, that's the policy that MIT uses, and I think a lot of universities follow something close to that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Langer, a pioneer in the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery. We'll hear more from Dr. Langer coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder of the Langer Labs at MIT, one of the world's largest biomedical engineering labs, with $10 million in annual grants and 100 researchers. Dr. Langer has helped to launch close to 30 companies, and he holds over 800 issued or pending patents. Dr. Langer has helped to launch nearly 30 companies and holds over 800 issued or pending patents. Dr. Langer holds over 800 issued or pending patents. 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed his lab's discoveries. We're talking about the profitability of some of these discoveries, and you turn to the private sector for the funding of some of these companies. Polaris is a venture capital company in Boston that has invested over $200 million in your companies, roughly 20 companies. How did that relationship start?
There was a company that I was starting with a woman named Sherry Oberg, and she was wanted to have a company that would create the new imaging agents, and we'd published a paper actually in Science that lended itself to doing that. She was a Dartmouth graduate in the business school. She knew a guy named Terry McGuire, and she introduced me to him. And it was probably early 90s, and she also asked if he was interested in investing in the company, which he did. So we've had a great relationship. I mean, like you said, they've probably done close to 20 companies that we've been involved in.
What are imaging agents? You said that you developed imaging.
Yeah. So in this case, let's say you were doing an ultrasound. And for certain things, you can use ultrasound and you know, get a pretty good picture. But for example, if you wanted to see whether you had a heart defect or certain other kinds of vascular abnormality, and you tried to use ultrasound, the contrast isn't good enough. So if you could create an ultrasound contrast agent that was good enough, then you could see things by ultrasound imaging that you wouldn't really be able to see otherwise. And you could certainly see it with much, much greater detail.
So for instance, if you're pregnant and you go to get an ultrasound, are some of these imaging agents used in seeing the baby in the placenta?
So in the case of looking at a baby, you don't need to do that because I think the contrast is good enough. But if you wanted to look at something much smaller, let's say you wanted to look at I'll make this up, the baby's toe or something like that, and you wanted to zoom in on it, might be very hard to see with a regular picture. The contrast agent might be useful for doing that. Mm-hmm. By the way, I think there are still hardly any ultrasound agents approved, the ultrasound contrast agents approved. I expect there will be by this or others, but it's a long road to getting approval for anything.
You mentioned that these have not been approved yet, and a firm like Polaris has been very patient. It's patient capital, understanding that they might not see proceeds for decades.
That's right. I mean, though they've done very well, as far as I know from what I guess people in business called an IRR standpoint. I mean, I think people in the investment business understand that when you're doing medical work, you don't do it on the sales at the time, you do it on the promise of the company. And that's turned out to work. I mean, an early company that I was an advisor to for many, many years was Genentech. And that came out in the stock market and did fantastic. And they had no products, a lot of promise. But ultimately, they did get products. And those products were blockbusters.
Let's talk about the entrepreneurial nature of what you've done. Sure. You're a pioneer in science. You are also a pioneer in tech transfer, in a way, in commercializing a lot of this research. What are some of the hurdles that you've faced entrepreneurially, even outside of, you know, the development of your lab in the early days in the 1980s?
Yeah, well, I think the challenges that you run into when you try to do entrepreneurial things, I mean, one is always raising money. But two is, again, some of your colleagues won't think highly of it. You know, Dr. Folkman actually said it very well once. He actually got one of the earliest industrial grants. He got about $23 million from Monsanto for his cancer research in the 1970s. And he was at a dinner and somebody asked him, what are the advantages and disadvantages of getting that kind of money? And he said, well, let me do the disadvantages first. He said, there's a gene that a lot of people have that's not expressed directly. It's expressed indirectly. And he said that gene is called jealousy. And if you're a young faculty member, that's not such a good thing because people can control your future. You know, and then a third thing is anytime you try to create any entity, you're dealing with all kinds of people. I mean, with different personalities. I mean, that's good because but somehow they have to come together to create this company. And you have to have good business people and good scientists and good clinical people. And sometimes there might be conflicts. And so you have to try to help on those things.
You've helped to launch close to 30 companies. It's not like you're being Jeff Bezos and you launched one company called Amazon. Here you have sprinkled dozens of companies around in your atmosphere. So how do you think about starting a company? Do you just say, well, here's a great idea, and hey, you CEO with this specific background, you go run with it, and I'll advise? You're like a godfather to these companies more than in the trenches every day.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably fair. I mean, to me, my major mission still is being a professor and teaching and doing research at MIT and training students. But I also want, when we create something, for it to get out to the public. And my students and postdocs, some of them will go into academic positions, some of them want to take their inventions and make a company out of it. And so so if we're fortunate enough to, A, have made an important discovery, and, B, have somebody who wants to run with it, you know, I want to help them do that.
Incidentally, some of the applications for your research have been in fields other than medicine. One example is in the waste industry. Can you describe that?
Well, actually, one of the things that one of our postdocs, Avi Doan, created was a polymer, but that would help in what's called flocculation.
And what
that means is, if, like, you have a swimming pool and you have waste or junk in the swimming pool, you know, it could be leaves or it could be, you know, dirt, anything, a flocculant is something that makes those things come together. So rather than it be over your entire pool, over your entire surface, it comes together and it's very easy to then remove. And so there's something that company licensed called Superflock that was very widely used.
What are some other tangible technologies that have come out of your lab that we might know of?
Well, we've created fat substitutes that people have used for foods.
What's an example? Like what product?
Like, for example, Hood no-fat sour cream or yogurts. Those use these products. Hmm. I mean, there are a whole bunch of things like that. There's a company we've started called Living Proof, which is in the hair care industry. And also Jennifer Aniston is involved in that as well.
As an investor.
Yes. And so there's products that the company and my students and postdocs and everybody we've and people at the company have created that can prevent frizzy hair, that can give hair more body. And of course, all the medical ones, some of the companies that we've been involved in, I mean, they've created products that can help people with schizophrenia, help people with alcoholism, help people with diabetes.
What's an example of an application of your discovery to treatment of alcoholism?
So the very first company that I got involved starting was a company called Enzatec. And what we did was make this came out from our early discoveries that we could make microspheres that could release molecules of any size. We merged that company with our downstairs neighbor, Alchemies. And basically that company has created a microsphere that can deliver a drug for a month. It's been shown to greatly reduce alcoholism.
So a microsphere being a polymer that releases a chemical that inhibits the desire to drink alcohol?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's a little microsphere that you can inject through a small needle once a month and does just what you said. You can also use that same microsphere to, reduce people's reliance on cocaine or narcotics as well.
We've talked a lot about polymers and controlled drug delivery to things like tumors. You've also spent a good portion of your career on tissue engineering, tissue regeneration. Can you describe what that is briefly?
Sure. Well, lots of times people have serious medical problems where they don't have, their liver's gone bad or they're burned or all kinds of problems where they don't have a tissue or an organ or it's been seriously damaged. So around 1983, a friend of mine, Jay Vacanti, he's head of pediatric surgery at Mass General. He came to talk to me about this. At that time, he was head of the liver transplant program at Children's Hospital. And we started talking about ways that we might be able to use plastics and cells, mammalian cells, to craft new tissues and organs. And that would eventually lead to new strategies for creating artificial skin for burn victims, new ways of creating, livers or, intestines. A lot of them are at the research stage. We're also looking at ways of making new spinal cords for people that are paralyzed, vocal cords for people that have difficulty speaking or singing. So all kinds of things like that.
So what is the tissue made of?
Well, the strategy that we use is you have a polymer plastic scaffold, and then you put the cells on it. And over time, the cells make what's called their own extracellular matrix. So all the same proteins, hopefully, and sugars and other things that are in the human body, to begin with, the cells recreate. Hmm. And over time, that plastic scaffold dissolves. It's a dissolvable scaffold that we've designed. So in essence, rather than ladies' girdles or other things, what you're having is what the body normally would have, which are what are called these extracellular matrix proteins and polysaccharides.
So the plastic delivers, it's sort of a platter for this artificial tissue, which flirts with or fraternizes with the real tissue in the body, and they cohere and intermingle and then become their own organism.
Yeah, I think that you said it pretty well.
Hmm.
Yeah. Each tissue has its own challenges, but that's sort of the general strategy that we've developed.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder and chief researcher of the Langer Labs at MIT. Dr. Langer holds over 800 issued or pending patents. 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed the discoveries originated in his labs. Dr. Langer is a magician. I'd like to turn to your personal life.
Sure.
Tell me about this magic.
Well, I've always been fascinated by magic. So from time to time, I try to learn how to do tricks. I mean, I remember taking even a magic class and, you know, I would always love going to magic shops and seeing people do tricks. And I used to do shows when my kids were little. And I remember one time even doing a show at MIT for 400 people. That was a while ago. I'm probably pretty rusty now.
Is there an area of magic that you prefer? Do you like the cards or the body disappearance or what?
Yeah, well, actually, I like the cards. People have often broken up magic into two kinds of magic, stage magic and close-up magic. Stage magic is like the body disappearing and things like that. But I've always liked the sort of close-up magic with cards or coins, but particularly cards. I've always thought those were fascinating.
In a way, magic and chemistry or science seem on the face of it very similar. You have something that, you know, on the surface is wow-generating. And your job and your hobby is to understand how to create that wow. Your job is to understand the reasons for that outcome.
I mean, some things could even, you know, appear like magic. Like we just published a paper a week or two ago in Science where some of my postdocs found like this plastic or polymer that can, you put it on your hand and it starts jumping all over the place. And it can even lift things. That's almost magical. And a lot of what we've ended up doing in the lab is understanding better phenomena that is extremely complicated.
How long have you been interested in magic?
Oh, I've been, you know, many, many years since I was a little boy.
You grew up in Albany, New York. What did your parents do?
Well, my dad ran a small liquor store and my mom was a homemaker. Took care of me and my sister.
What was your home life like?
It was great. I mean, you know, we lived on a small street in Albany. You know, I had a lot of friends. I remember playing baseball and football and things like that. And I went to the local public school, 27. It was nice.
You're an inventor, essentially. At what point did you think, you know, I'd like to be an inventor or some type of creator or engineer in your childhood? Were those seeds apparent to you that early?
They weren't apparent to me that early, but one of the things that I had that I got as gifts, there was a company called Gilbert when I was a little boy, and they made all kinds of great things that kids like to play with. I mean, they had this Erector set, and they had a whole bunch of different ones of various complexity, you know, where you could build structures like a merry-go-round, another where there was like a parachute jump, another where you could launch rockets. And then they also had a microscope set, and they had a chemistry set. And so I really enjoyed that kind of stuff when I was a little boy. And I even like with the chemistry set, I remember mixing different chemicals together and watching the solutions change color, which is magic. But also, it was a chemical reaction going on that caused that. But I never thought about inventing it. I just thought it was fun.
Would you say that you fell into what you're doing accidentally, or was it more mindful?
Well, I think it's somewhat accidental. I mean, you know, I certainly had no grand plan ever. I think the big thing that changed it for me in terms of what I ended up doing was what my postdoctoral work after I graduated from MIT when I went to work for Judah Folkman. And I was like probably one of the few chemical engineers in the world, maybe the only one working in a surgery lab. And I started thinking about applying chemical engineering to medicine. And that certainly changed my life.
Dr. Folkman compared research to driving at night. Can you describe that analogy?
Yes, that's very good. Dr. Folkman said, you know, trying to solve the problem of angiogenesis or some of the other things would be kind of like driving at night. You can't see past where the headlights go, but you can do the whole trip that way. So in other words, you don't know the answer when you're starting, but you could make steps, and those steps would eventually get you there.
What are some images that come to your mind when you think of your research? You know, when is this driving at night? What about like crystallization? You know, how they have a formation of a crystal and it becomes like this whole network of crystals.
Right, right.
But like that's
rock candy. That's significant. I mean, that's an example. I mean, certainly one thing that actually we were involved in. In fact, we started a company on that too was a company called Transform, where one of the challenges actually when you make pharmaceuticals is having a good shelf life, because you don't want to use a drug if the drug after you make it is unstable after a month. Nobody's going to use it. You're going to ship it all over the world. You need it, and a lot of times you won't use a drug for a year or two. So getting the drug in the right crystal form, that's in the right stability, that actually is a big deal. If you don't get it in the right crystal form, it may not be stable, and then it won't be useful to anybody. But if it is in the right crystal form, it can be very stable.
You exercise daily. How long have you been exercising, and why is it so important to you?
Well, I've probably been exercising probably those last 32 years, 33 years. It's important. Well, my dad died of a heart attack when he was 61, and, you know, I was 28 at the time. I mean, I just you know, want to live as long as I can for my kids and my wife and my family. And
what kind of what do you do for exercise?
Well, I use a recumbent bike, elliptical machine, treadmill, and weights.
For how long?
Probably 2 to 3 hours a day.
So 2 to 3 hours, that seems above average.
I think it's probably quite a bit above average, certainly for somebody my age. But I'm able to work while I do it, and my wife and kids actually exercise a lot. And, you know, we have this gym at home, so sometimes we're all doing it together, or at least a few of us. And so, it is certainly above average.
Hmm. You mentioned your wife. You met your wife at MIT. She's a neuroscientist. How did you meet?
We met on the track. I was running actually outside, and so was she. I knew her, though, a little bit because one of the people in our lab was roommates with her, so I knew her a little bit. But then so I saw her on the track, and we started talking. So that's how that happened.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
My guest has been the chemical engineer, Dr. Robert Langer. Coming up, we'll meet Roy and Bertrand Sosa, co-founders of Netspend. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Roy and Bertrand Sosa, co-founders of Netspend, the first prepaid debit card company for the underbanked population in the United States. Netspend was launched in 1999 and targets people who don't have access to credit cards or hold bank accounts. Roy and Bertrand started the company out of their one-bedroom apartment in Texas with $750. They later raised $1.5 billion in an IPO in 2010 and sold the company in early 2013 to Total System Services, a payment processing company, for approximately $1.4 billion. They are the co-founders of Empower Ventures, an investment fund focused on financial service companies for the underbanked. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
You immigrated from Mexico to the United States in 1986 when you were teenagers. What were your first impressions of America, Bertrand?
As the World Turns, because I learned English watching As the World Turns with my mother. And the other parts came from watching Transformers in the morning.
How about you, Roy?
Missing the bus, going to my first day of school in Austin, Texas, and having my tennis shoes stolen and not speaking the language. Yeah, it was not a good start. Pretty tough when coming back from a country where, for me, everything clicked.
Now, you moved from Mexico with your mother, and she wanted to kind of reinvent herself. She had been working in business administration, and she wanted to study medicine. Where was your father in this?
Our father, he's a professor of economics, and so they had split a few years back, and so he was in Mexico City.
Roy, you joined the Marine Corps after high school before entering college. Given your allegiance to Mexico, why did you join the Marines?
Literally, Saddam had invaded Kuwait, and I had been in this country for 4 years, and I had really come to the conclusion that whereas before I wanted to get back to Mexico as soon as possible, I had come to just love this country and the opportunities. And I felt that there was no way that I was ever really going to feel that this was my home the same way that my peers that have been born here. And so I just had this idea of what better way than join the Marines during time of war.
After college, you both worked at MCI, the telephone company.
Now Verizon.
It was at MCI that the idea for Netspend hatched. And it seems like you are both very unlikely people to start a financial services company, especially given that you were at a telephone company and you didn't have a background in financial services. How did the idea for Netspend come to be?
We were living together at the time when we overlapped work at MCI WorldCom, and we were just talking about the internet boom and how there's a new business being hatched every day, it seemed like. And so you can imagine, especially in Austin, Texas, Michael Dell has just entered into the picture. And without living in Austin, I don't know if we would have had the momentum of entrepreneurship that we felt. Literally, it happened over a few days where we started talking about doing something together. I remember him walking into my room and saying, I got it. Mm-hmm. We're going to enable payments over the internet.
At the time, e-commerce was just blooming. And people were starting to buy things online. However, there was this whole population of people who didn't have access to credit cards. And the thought was, how are they going to transact? In what way did this stem from your own experience or frustration with the payment system?
As a student at the University of Texas and having had financial aid checks coming in from my GI Bill, I had come to understand that if I came in and I deposited my $2,000 check at my bank account, deposited my check on Friday at 4 p.m., guess what? Even though I had a debit card, I could not get the funds to clear my account until after midnight Monday, which puts it Tuesday. So if I needed to buy books on the internet, or if I wanted to buy flowers for my girlfriend from 1-800-Flowers, I couldn't do anything. The electronics seem to be there. They have my money. Why? Why can't I do this? And that was really what motivated us to say, we cannot possibly be the only ones.
While it was the early days, prepaid cards did exist in the form of phone cards, for example. And in what way did phone cards inspire you to just apply it to a different area?
In a big way for me. I mean, we were working directly in the industry, and we had context coming from Mexico where you know, very popular way of transacting.
When we were at MCI, one of our college jobs initially was to sign people up to switch in long distance. And curiously enough, switching people from AT&T to MCI, that was easy. The ones that were super difficult were not only immigrants, but your average American that had gotten a $400, $500 phone bill, and they couldn't pay it. And they had gotten so burned with that experience that they decided, you know what, I'm going to buy prepaid cards. And we could tell that customer, Mr. Customer, you know, you can have the service for 5 cents a minute, and the prepaid card is 30 cents. And the customer would tell us, yes, I know. I know it's more expensive, but you know what? When I'm done with the card, I'm done with the card.
More control.
It's control. As a person, I have problems about maybe not exercising enough, maybe not having the right diet. And certainly, I'm going to have a problem with spending and saving. And if you can give me something where I can have control, that would be very powerful.
You launched the company with $750, which is basically the amount of money that it costs to incorporate.
$750 was utilized to incorporate, and that was really the catalyst to no going back.
So we put a list of friends and family, and it's really funny, the 20 people that we put on the list, they ended up not giving us any money. But what we ended up getting, these first investors are former employees at MCI. So think about people that were call center agents. When you're talking about an investment from a friend or a former employee that is $5,000 when their annual income, I know for a fact because they used to work for me, was $60,000, it's a big deal.
And then you looked to venture capital and you got a lot of no's because you didn't have experience. What were some other reasons why venture folks did not support you initially?
I'll give you the response that we got from one particular investor that we were looking for money from. And he looked at us and he said, you guys are hilarious. It's like you're trying to go to the Super Bowl and win, but you've got two players. I mean, I didn't even know what venture capital was mm-hmm. when we were looking for venture capital.
You ended up raising money from the help of the Small Business Administration. They had this SBIC program, which insured investments from venture funds, right? It backed or collateralized investments from venture funds. Is that right?
That is correct.
They supported one of our investors, early investors. They had received some money from the government, and it turned out that we were one of the portfolio companies of the year for the government.
And who was the venture firm?
Jeffenor
here out of New York.
In the early days, you persuaded MasterCard to partner with you. How did you meet them?
We were introduced to them by our partner bank out of Texas.
And to their credit, they were very open. You got to remember, 1998, the internet is expanding. And back in those days, we basically said, look, we have an agreement with ExxonMobil for distribution of these cards. They need to be able to get their cash into the system. And how are you going to deal with that? And if you don't want to help us, that's fine. But then this is our first stop, and maybe we can go to American Express, or maybe we can go to Visa, but somebody's going to do it.
So Exxon was a real important ally for you in convincing the likes of MasterCard to work with you.
ExxonMobil being Fortune 1.
So, for example, when you think about MasterCard or Visa, they do not issue cards. Banks do. The biggest retail bank in America back then had a total of 5,000 branches. ExxonMobil had 15,000 locations. So the concept that you can actually reach people through a retail location instead of a bank branch was really an innovation in itself. The other thing that we also had was our technology. So because the stuff that we wanted to do had never been done before, the incumbents, they were very rigid. If you as a bank said, I want to change this and that, they would say, okay, we can make those changes, but it's going to cost you millions of dollars and it's going to be 2-3 years. They also were operating on mainframes. We had the benefit of, we were working on servers from the internet age where instead of spending $20 million on infrastructure, we could do it for a couple million dollars faster, better.
How did you convince Exxon to make your cards available to the population?
They took a leap of faith on a pilot in Texas. And so literally hopped on a plane, went to see them in Fairfax, Virginia, said, hey, we want to do this. Here's a card. I remember putting a card in front of the gentleman that handled U.S. distribution for their C-stores. He picked it up, looked at it. This, by the way, had been a card that I had designed personally and printed and laminated and all that. And I remember he looked at it and said, okay, let's do it. And he signed the term sheet.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Bertrand and Roy Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend, a pioneer of prepaid debit cards for the underbanked. Launched in 1999, NetSpend provides cards and other financial services to people who don't have access to credit or bank accounts. It occurred to me that you are innovating at the bottom of the pyramid. You're serving people who have real needs, and one day these services will be or eventually were used by mainstream customers. And usually when we think of innovation, sometimes it happens top down, like at the top of the pyramid, and then eventually, you know, the people at the bottom would benefit. Have you thought about that dynamic?
We have. Today, globally, we now have programs in places like Kosovo, where we completely help rebuild the entire financial system in terms of the infrastructure for card issuance and acceptance. And, you know, the small business owner that now can order enzymes for his dairy business that he couldn't before.
Enzymes, yeah.
And that he couldn't do it before. And you asked this question of, you know, you started innovating at the bottom of the pyramid. Well, we have to be super low cost. You obviously can't talk about big fees. We have programs where literally we make $1 per customer per year. Okay, so for you to make it work, you have to leverage technology, you have to leverage partnerships. But once you do that, then all of a sudden you say, wow, I can actually deliver services to the top of the pyramid more efficiently, better service than the incumbents that have been used to high fees. Because I had to figure it out. So instead of building a branch, I partnered with a grocery store. Instead of building a branch, I partnered with an airline.
Or a telco.
Or a telco.
You are no longer affiliated with NetSpend. You started an investment fund called Empower, which invests in financial service companies serving the underbanked population. And unfortunately, it got off to a rough start in that you were the subject of a lawsuit and injunctions were filed against you from Netspend, from the very company that you founded. And that was a tumultuous period for you, I'm sure. And the company contended that you were taking employees and that you had a non-compete and that you were starting companies that competed directly with Netspend. What was your response to that?
No, my two cents on that is that it was a silly time for both of us. There's just no reason for it. We clear the air between both sides.
The short answer is I can tell you all those things were dismissed. But at the same time, I will also tell you because of confidentiality on the dismissal and whatnot, we really don't talk about it. But I can tell you from a human perspective, it is the equivalent of being sued by your child. For me, it was even more awkward as a founder to think about the fact that, okay, at the time, we were the largest individual shareholders. So if Netspend won, we lost. But if Netspend lost, we lost. And it just didn't make sense. You know, I've never sued anybody in my entire life. To me, it's disappointing when companies or individuals view the game as a zero sum. Like, if you're winning, I must be losing. So how do I get a piece of that? Netspend had the opportunity to go international for many years. Never did. There's nothing that prevents them from doing that.
So what you're saying is Netspend decided not to go into these other markets internationally, and there you saw an opportunity elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, we started doing things around mobile payments right away and going into other countries right away. And, you know, the product line spectrum that we have today is pretty significantly different than what you see back then.
Your focus now is on Rev Worldwide, which is a portfolio company of Empower, and they have a network of payment companies for those without access to banking. So similar to Netspend, but international. What are some examples, or who are some of the people whom are being affected by this?
In rural Mexico, there's no cell phone coverage. There's no mobile coverage. So we partner with the telegraph company and with Huawei, who actually came in and put a satellite antenna, and we enabled everybody in a township of 500 families to be able to operate and be able to have both access to telecommunications, but also to the banking system.
The people in Mexico that are using the Mi Phone product are impacted in a very, very real way. I mean, you have this merchant that's selling chicken, and now, because he's able to take phone orders and have them be paid to his cell phone, he doesn't have to go to the collect the cash and then take the cash to the bank. And, you know, all these inefficiencies that when you think about, I mean, we may take them for granted, but when for somebody to go half a day across town, another half a day, come back, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal in terms of time and money. And we have successfully bridged that divide through the mobile phone and through a debit card. Another way that Rev is impacting around the world, you're talking about cab drivers in Australia that are getting paid via their driver's card. Through our technology, their headquarters disperses the money directly to them. And, you know, I can go on and on about all the different examples.
Your mom is living in Texas currently. What does she make of all this?
It's really funny you ask that question, because throughout the early years at Netspend, I don't think she really understood what we were doing. When it relates to things about work, it's more about I need to, you know, help her reset her pen, or I get a tickle out of that every single time.
Where was your father in this?
My father, who's a professor, he still would like for me to go out and finish some sort of graduate school. He's never been a big pro-capitalist or entrepreneur supporter, so there's a bit of unfinished business there.
You said your father's a professor of economics in Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm. Is he socialist?
How did you guess? Why would have led you to believe that?
All you have to do is meet my mother and my father to understand why Roy is half mission-driven and half capitalistic-driven.
I grew up going to summer camps with the Boy Scouts, and every other year going to summer camps with the Cuban Pioneers. And I grew up with a poster of a $6 million man next to the poster of Ernesto Che Guevara.
They
go hand in hand. I don't think you divorce one from the other.
You guys are two immigrants from Mexico, and Netspend had a $1.5 billion IPO in 2010, and more recently was sold for almost $1.5 billion. Were you like, is this really happening to me?
Yeah, all the time. You know, what I really pinch myself is it's not necessarily the IPO or Netspend or the prepaid. I pinch myself that I was able to find the path of entrepreneurship. When I discovered that entrepreneurs, it wasn't necessarily a dirty word, but it was a very, again, a very empowering feeling, it blew my mind.
I want to elaborate on that concept of dirty word. From an entrepreneur's perspective, in Mexico, an entrepreneur is somebody who doesn't know what they want to do. Being an entrepreneur is the guy that is just sort of wheeling and dealing. And so it was fantastic to really have come to a country at a time where this is really exploding. And if you can believe that, a couple of Mexican immigrants that came in on a tourist visa, that the visa had an expiration date, and that by all means should not be here, that we could create a company that could lead an industry that could create so many jobs.
That is extremely empowering.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
My guests have been the financial service entrepreneurs, Roy and Bertrand Sosa. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.